Hey everyone, welcome to the fifth episode of Wild True FM, recorded on the 10th of December, 2017. Wild True FM is a podcast about random, hopefully interesting tidbits from technology, programming, entertainment, and whatever other stuff we decide to throw at you. Your hosts are Kenneth Love,
Mike Overby,
Sam Rose,
and Daniel Lamond.
All right, it's time for our first topic, and I think today it's going to be talking about a rather nasty runtime bug in the Go programming language, Golang.
Yes. So there's been an article going around entitled Debugging an Evil Go Runtime Bug, and this is like a whirlwind of amazing debugging. It's such a fantastic story. So it starts out with a former Google SRE talking about Prometheus and Grafana. So Prometheus is a monitoring tool that closely mimics some of Google's internal monitoring tools, and Grafana is a system for graphing time series. The author is talking about how he uses Prometheus and Grafana in some of his day-to-day life and some of his stuff that he's monitoring at home. But on a specific machine, his laptop, he talks about the fact that one of the Go binaries that exports metrics just crashes randomly, and he can't figure out why. It's just this one machine, and he's going through this debugging, and he's trying to figure out like what the similarities are, like why doesn't it, like what the variables are, and he eventually narrows it down to the compiler and the kernel being used, and he does these just phenomenal feats of debugging that I would never in a million years have thought of. Like the bit that really stood out to me was he narrows it down to a bug in the kernel, and to find out what part of the kernel the bug is in, he compiles each object file in the kernel using different compile options, and he generates a hash of what's been compiled with what options. And event, like, he just continually kind of compares these hashes and narrows down the section that's showing problems. And I highly recommend reading this article. Did any of you three read it?
Yes, like three times.
So at what point did you realize that you're just not worthy?
About after we started getting through the assembly stuff. Like everything else I got. Like once we started like hitting the RAM errors, I was like, okay, this I get. And then we started getting into him heating it up with a heat gun. I was like, wow, this is really extensive, but I understand. And then we got into digging deeper and like bisecting machines. So we were like doing some bash scripting. I was like, okay, this I understand. And then we got into assembly and I was like, we are way over my head now. But yeah, I really enjoyed it. I mean, it's in Go. So I saw Go in the title and was like, well, I guess I'm reading this article. Yeah. I think the debugging nature, I think debugging is a severely undervalued section of like a professional programmer's toolkit. And so to see something like this pop up where he's like, yeah, I spent 3 days debugging this and dug through every possible solution was really good. I really enjoyed it.
I completely agree with you that debugging is not nearly highlighted enough as a skill to the point where I feel like you could probably teach college courses just on debugging.
Okay, so I'm not going to be the parade rainer and say it's ridiculous that a modern language like Go requires somebody to disassemble their machine and heat up parts of it with a heat gun in order to figure out why something is failing.
You're completely right. You're completely right that it is ridiculous.
Like,
but
that's just
the yeah. Nature of this bug was, so it's not necessarily a fault with Go, right?
It's just, it's kind of ridiculous that we're still at the point where we're like, you know what? I should disassemble this machine. I should tear apart the base most workings of my computer, you know, the kernel and the compiler, just to figure out why this code is erroring.
He probably, if I had a hazard guess, he probably didn't have to. He didn't have to go through all of these steps. He probably could have made like software changes and checked to see if it worked. The only reason I think he checked RAM is because he found that there was one bad sector on his RAM, and he was like, well, maybe this is
contributing
to the way that I'm having errors with Go. Yeah, so he ended up, he ran a mem test, and he had a bad bit, and so then he heated up his RAM to see if there were more bad bits, and there were like three more, but not enough to cause this
error. Probably should have a debugging course, and he should be taking it, because he went way off track on debugging.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I would say that
he did, man. Come on.
Well, he did due diligence, so because the code was failing at random points, and he did a mem test, and he had one bad bit of RAM, he did due diligence just to make sure that that wasn't the problem. So he isolated those sections of RAM and masked them away from being used by the kernel, just as a, like, you know, let's just be sure that this is not the problem. And I can get behind that.
I was not even aware that you could specify bad RAM bits inside Grub.
Yeah, I didn't know that. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. I was like, oh, I can just tell it to avoid RAM? That's
nice. I typically try to assume that any of the old Unix tools, such as Grub, have way more magic powers than I will ever know about.
Yeah, you're like, oh, there are a billion things I can do, and I will ever only know 1,000 of them.
I won't even know that many. I'll know, like, 3. I mean, how many of you can open a tar file on the first try?
I can. 100%.
Really?
tar-xvzf. And then the file.
I have the set of flags that I use, and right. have a vague idea of what they do.
Right. How many of the flags to LS do you know?
I just know dash A and dash L.
I know L, T, R, and H. Occasionally A.
Right, and we're all missing like 50.
I do
50
that through muscle memory.
Yeah.
The only reason I know the tar one is because ML datasets come in tar.gzs.
Okay, but what if it's bzip?
I'm out of luck. Google it is.
No shame in that.
No shame in what?
Yeah. And
no shame in Googling it.
No, not at all.
No. So something else I didn't realize was he does the funky stuff with generating QEMU images.
Yep.
I didn't realize you could do that kind of thing. Like, you just like really, really minimalist kernels that don't even have support for, what did he say? No file system support, no file system. Yeah. No file systems, no block devices, doesn't even support PCI, had no networking, but, you know, still displayed the problem, so worked for his purposes.
Yeah, the funny thing is he talked about how he ran it on Gentoo and then found out that not only was it most likely a kernel issue, but it was also most likely an issue with GCC, and so, like, he had to, like, compile it with, like, a certain GCC on a certain kernel version. This is a wonder of modern debugging, to be honest with you.
I honestly would have just given up.
I would have given up. Oh yeah, no question. Yeah.
I don't even have a heat gun. Yeah, I don't have a heat gun.
It just turned out that they were running into issues where the stack was really big, right? And it was trying to allocate into an out of bounds, and then it was just crashing.
Yeah, there was an assumption made by Go that the stack is larger than it actually was.
It would have been really amazing if it was like, oh, I should have been using greater than or equals instead of just greater than.
Yeah. It's just an off by one.
Yeah, right. Just, I just missed this one. Dan, you mentioned that your ML datasets come in from as tar files. And yep. You also put into our show notes that you wanted to talk about DeepMind's new paper.
Yeah, I heard, like, something slightly above average significance happened this week.
Slightly above average significance. Yes, there was indeed a slightly above average significant event that happened at DeepMind this week. We'll get into the kind of, like, significantly slightly. We'll get into some of the hardware things later. We'll get to that in a minute, because I think Google had an unfair advantage in the way that they trained this. But we'll get back to how the paper works. So DeepMind released a new... It was a chess go, another game, Shoji, I think. Essentially a deep learning model that trained against itself using a reinforcement method and then was put against Stockfish, which is like the best chess engine on the planet, after like 4 hours of training and bodied Stockfish. Like, it wasn't even close. It hung two pawns and a rook, I believe, in the early game, or like two pawns and a knight, and still somehow managed to come back and like thoroughly defeat Stockfish. It plays a really aggressive white side. There's a lot of chess analysis too, but I don't want to go into it too much. But the impressive thing was that it had managed to do so after 4 hours, because usually ML models take much longer to train. If anyone here has ever delved into ML land, it's usually like several days worth of training, or weeks if you're doing like ImageNet type stuff and like larger ResNets. But 4 hours is really impressive and really cool. And the fact that it also then thoroughly defeated what was largely considered to be like an amazing chess engine in Stockfish. If you've ever played against Stockfish, it's pretty much impossible to beat as a human because it doesn't make mistakes is the idea. But apparently it does because AlphaGo Zero beat it. Now, there are a couple caveats here, which I don't know if DeepMind like really goes into in depth in their paper, but they need to be said. It was trained on 4 TPUs. I think it was 4 TPUs, which are a very specific ASIC designed only for ML work, and which are also Google proprietary, conveniently, and also are very fast. So the calculations that they can do, as opposed to what you can do on like your normal GTX 1080 or what have you, are very different. It's low precision. It's only 8-bit floating precision, as opposed to like 32 or 64, which is what you'll normally find in NVIDIA cards. But it's really fast. So the calculations it makes for chess, like, we strictly can't keep up with on like normal consumer hardware. But yeah, it was a wonder of human achievement. 4 hours is really fast. The method they took, the reinforcement-based method that they were doing, was pretty interesting. They did some cool stuff with, I believe, an activation function, I want to say. But they had developed a new algorithm to do some of this stuff. So yeah, DeepMind paper, AI is coming, we're all dead.
Winding back a little bit. You can rent TPUs on Google Compute Engine, right?
You can rent Teslas, but I don't think those are strictly TPUs.
I was Googling this in the background, and it does seem to be in alpha something.
It looks like you can. They're also horrifically expensive.
Right. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
You said like a ton of words that I didn't fully understand. Like,
okay, I'm back.
How significant is this? Is this like world-leading breakthrough in thing, or is it like pushing a small section of the world forward?
So it's like world-leading breakthrough, I would lean towards. And there's a couple reasons for this. One, the AlphaGo Zero played chess very differently from anything else. The thing you run into with chess engines usually is that they have a tendency to play pretty reserved, and the decisions they make usually take a second, because they calculate like every possible position on the board for like 10 straight moves, which computers can do and humans can't. And so it has a tendency to take a second for them to make decisions. But AlphaGo Zero doesn't do that. It only calculates up to like 4 moves ahead, but it still somehow manages to play in such a way that its white side is super aggressive. Like, its white side regularly hangs pieces and plays like an ultra aggro style. It develops new openings and new moves that haven't been seen before, kind of like what AlphaGo did with Go when it played against when it played Go against the number one player in the world. And then it does so in such a way that it only did it after 4 hours. I mean, after 4 hours it was making these decisions, which is something that really isn't seen in ML.
Another question I was going to ask, so 2 questions. So when you say hang a pawn, do you mean leave a pawn open to be taken?
Yes. So, on a top of, in chess, you usually want to trade pieces. So like if they take a pawn, you also want to take a pawn so you can maintain like decent board position. And so what AlphaGo Zero was doing was actually losing pawns for no trade. And it was doing so in order to set up further advantageous positions down the board, which is something that like chess engines really aren't known for. Chess engines aren't known for kind of playing this like ultra aggro, I'll drop a piece here for an advantage down the board. They usually trade out, usually evenly. And I think that's what Stockfish was trying to do if you watch some of its moves. But it was something that I had not seen before, and that after watching a few chess analysts kind of go through this AlphaGo Zero Stockfish game, they were like, this is crazy. Like, the AlphaGo Zero has like an unimaginably high ELO.
You also mentioned 4 hours, and I'm wondering, is that 4 hours wall clock time, or is it 4 compute hours? Because it feels like 4 hours wall clock time is a meaningless metric.
4 hours wall clock time is actually... So, on a TPU, I couldn't tell you how much that is, because I haven't messed with like a TPU-based ML system. On like a GPU, training a chess engine takes a while, and especially if I was going to be doing like a reinforcement-based, where I'm essentially having it play itself over and over and over again in order to improve... You have to understand that like both of those then have to improve in order for the machine to get better. And so it usually it's done in like incremental steps, but for it to go from I have never been a chess engine to I'm beating the best chess engine in the world by a significant margin in 4 hours of wall clock time is pretty impressive in machine learning and deep learning land. That's very short.
So you mentioned that it takes fewer moves to, or that it looks fewer moves ahead. Do you think that means that it'll affect how humans play chess in the future too? Like, I mean, I don't know like the extent of how many moves a human could look in the future feasibly, but I know that the game graph of chess is gigantic, so it can't be that many. But
it's measured.
Do you think there would be an effect?
So for top chess masters, probably not. Like chess GMs already think like a significant number of moves ahead. Like Magnus Carlsen, from my understanding, thinks like 7 or 8 moves ahead, which is really hard to keep track of, like exactly how people are going to move their pieces. Usually what's recommended for like general like 1600 or 1700 ELO for like your above average player is like 3 or 4. And then your bad players will keep track of like maybe 1. But the interesting thing about AlphaGo Zero is that I don't think it'll change the way chess masters play, chess GMs play, because we just can't match what a computer does. So trying to be like, oh, like I'm going to keep track of all of these moves for all of the pieces on the board ends up being kind of foolish for human players. I mean, we lost out to chess machines in like the 80s or 90s. We'll never beat them again.
But that's not what I meant. Like, I mean, how significant the change from trying to look 10 moves ahead as a computer to trying to look four moves ahead could be. Because perhaps, even if you want to take humans out of it, perhaps we could make a better chess engine for whatever reason. I mean, it's pretty clear that machine learning is the way to go in this area. But say we did try and make a better machine that could do chess, then maybe it wouldn't have to look that many moves ahead. Maybe that would narrow the goal and make it easier, but I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think it'll be interesting to see how chess engines kind of evolve. Like this, the idea that it was dropping pieces is something that hadn't been seen before. And the idea that it played super aggressively is also something that hadn't really been seen before. And so I don't know how this will affect like additional ML play, especially as we start to go forward in the nature of how it's calculating moves and everything. So this is the interesting thing. And I'll copy paste this to you guys in our Discord really fast.
And we'll make sure and put it into the show notes.
Yeah, that too. So the thing is that AlphaZero only analyzes 80,000 positions per second and 40,000 in Shogi, but Stockfish analyzes 70 million. So like that computational decrease is a massive boon for ML and machine learning and deep learning as models like this go forward. Because if it can achieve superhuman performance after 300,000 steps in 4 hours of wall time, and it does so for far less position computation, this is a pretty big deal. Because this could be applied towards a lot of things. Like, how did we end up making it so that AlphaGo Zero only has to analyze 80,000, and yet after just mere hours of training is already by far the best in the world? Like, how did we get to this? And DeepMind knows, I don't really know if they went into depth on it, but
can it just like decide that certain parts of the decision tree are just not worth going down much better than everyone else?
I think that's where they ended up going, but they don't really go into depth. They basically say AlphaZero compensates for the lower number of valuations by using its deep neural network to focus more selectively on the most promising variations, arguably more human-like approach. So it essentially drops things that aren't worth it, which like Stockfish doesn't do, and Elmo does not do either. I guess Elmo is another chess engine, or maybe a Shoji engine. It's really fast. It drops bad moves, which is something that hasn't been seen before. It does so with less steps, and it learns faster than anything else. So that's a pretty big jump in machine learning and deep learning, especially in chess engines. And we found that if you can do stuff with chess engines, it's usually applicable to other domains as well.
So how repeatable does the paper make this? Is there something now that other teams will be able to look at, try and reproduce, and then similarly get these kind of gains? Or is it still quite hush-hush?
It's still quite hush-hush. So like they don't go really into depth on the type of model that they used, other than the fact that it's a reinforcement model. They talk a little bit about how it's only a single neural network, so they don't run like multiple, which is interesting, but they don't use that either. They talked about how they used a Monte Carlo tree search, which is beneficial, but doesn't really get into how the neural network taught itself or the deep learning model learned. So it'll be interesting. I think other people will try and decode it, kind of like what happened with the WaveNet when it was announced by DeepMind a couple years ago. They talked about some of the infrastructure, but they didn't really talk about a lot of it, and yet people still decoded it. I've been messing with WaveNets for the past couple weeks. But yeah, it's still decently hush-hush. Like DeepMind didn't release the updated WaveNet either with reduced generation time for audio samples.
Yeah, I was going to say, obviously the next step up from playing chess is thermonuclear war, right? Just aged myself there.
Yeah, but... well, I mean, games are really difficult. So for now, the interesting thing will be if you can, the interesting thing is if I could train it on like chess and then point it at Go, and if it would use some of the skills it knows from chess to try and learn Go, because then you'd have like a transferable.
It's just
network.
A language.
Yeah, dude, I know. It's funny. You actually have to look up Golang. Don't tell Ken Pike. He gets upset.
Yeah, they really named it badly.
Yeah, I can't argue that point. Do you know there was already a Go programming language when Go was invented?
Yeah.
Same with Swift.
The guy tried to argue with
it's
Google
almost like that gigantic corporations can snuff out the little guy without considering that they existed first.
The guy who
so
made
on the subject
of
snuffing
Go
out
language.
The little guy.
Wow. All right. How is this? Hold on. How is this this segue going?
So you kind of screwed me up because I was going with chess to thermonuclear war to the other kind of robotic apocalypse, which is where machines just take over our lives. And then I was going to say that Sam wanted to talk about iPhones and Alexa.
That would have been awesome.
You were playing the long game there.
He was thinking seven moves ahead. He was using his Monte Carlo simulation
Forget
tree.
Forget chess.
What you don't know, what you don't know is that I'm actually just a Segway engine. So
oh.
I'm being trained in real time.
I'm so sorry. I don't know why you're training with us.
This is like the worst data set I've ever had.
The first episode.
Yeah, this is the worst data set I've ever had. But
this is the worst data set I've ever had.
So I bought an iPhone X.
How do you like it, Sam? Was it worth $1,000?
So I didn't pay $1,000 for it.
Was it worth
$600? Story goes.
Oh, I've been judging you ever since you mentioned it, but you didn't pay for everything.
I originally wasn't going to get one, but somebody in work had one that they didn't want, and it was like brand new, unwrapped, as in like it was still sealed. And they were selling it for like $900 instead of $1,000. And it was
wow.
And I could go and walk over difference. I could go and walk over to his desk and pick it up like 5 minutes later. So I thought, yeah, go on. So I bought it. What I will say up front is it is not worth $1,000. Not mm-hmm. to say it's bad, because it is very, very, very good, but it is 100% absolutely unequivocally overpriced. But we
I
all
mean,
need
it's
that.
It's just another iPhone.
It is. It is. There are some great parts about it. So, for example,
no. It's got a notch, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a notch.
We have to adapt the internet
how
to
many,
the notch.
How many animojis hey. Have you made, Sam? How many animojis have you made?
So, in total?
Yes.
Zero.
Zero? What?
I haven't got that far, but so a couple of reasons. I have been taking so many slow-mo videos. Because it does 1080p at 240 fps, so I've been getting so much slow-mo snow footage because it's snowing a lot here right now. I have a really great video of my girlfriend throwing a snowball at the window and slow-mo like seeing it explode onto the window. It's pretty cool.
I was about to ask if you're going to post these on YouTube for us to enjoy and for us to put in the show notes, but then you said girlfriend.
She
like, eh.
she absolutely would not want that. But the phone itself is great. The screen is magnificent. I've never seen a screen quite this nice. Face ID is great. I wasn't sure if I would like it. I did like Touch ID quite a lot, but Face ID is actually way more convenient. I like the camera. It's really nice. I like that it can do 4K video at 60 frames per second. But really, other than that, it's just a nice phone. Like, there's nothing enormously special about it.
So are you going to be keeping it?
Yeah, definitely. No question.
Okay.
Spend $900 on a phone, don't keep it. What is
that? Well, the person before him spent $1,000 on the phone and didn't keep it. So,
the story there was he bought the phone because he'd gone to the US on a business trip, and a friend of his had said, if you find an iPhone X in stock, because this is back when it wasn't in stock, buy it and I'll buy it off you when you come back. And he did, and it turned out his friend had found one through a different channel and forgotten to tell him, so he had to sell it on. Which kind of sucks for him, but you know, it's great for me.
Well, hey, now he's got an opening for a new friend.
Whoa, wow.
All right. Shots fired.
I have learned to never cross Ken. Holy moly. Hey, man, I wanted to buy this phone from you, but I got it somewhere else. Sorry, I totally spaced to tell you you're out of town. We're no longer friends. Oh, wow. That was an awfully big jump.
I mean, considering the shared workplace they have, it probably made that money back in an hour.
I mean, look, I only have so many years left in my life. I've got to make sure that it's filled with the best friends possible. You and
that's fair. They say you're the average of the five people you surround yourself with, which is why I don't hang out with you guys. Hey.
Yeah.
Yeah, see, Ken's on the safe boat.
I feel genuinely hurt. So I have an Alexa.
Have you not met Dan?
And I can tell it to do things like turn my kettle on. So it's just amazing. I can just be sitting there and it's like, Alexa, turn the kettle on. And it does it. And it actually works more often than not, which is something I've been frustrated about with voice assistant kind of things. They just don't do what I expect them to do when I say things. But so far, Alexa seems to mostly understand when I say what I say. I've been trying to get increasingly northern every time, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with what a northern British accent sounds like, but it would be along the lines of, Alexa, put kettle on, and she understands, she gets it. Love it.
Yeah, I've actually read that certain accents are partly like becoming less prevalent or in danger of dying off because of the voice revolution, I guess.
Really?
Like, yeah, I don't remember specifically where, but I read an article eons ago that was about like a really small town, I think in the UK somewhere, where they had like this really niche accent that's only spoken there, so the training set was never updated with something similar. So in order to use them, they have to, you know, do an impression of like a London accent. So it's just less work to just speak with a London accent.
Oh. Yeah, that makes sense. My mom has she's native to Oklahoma and has their odd mix of, it's not exactly South, but it's a country accent to some degree. And she has a lot of trouble with Siri understanding her. So she basically just gave up on it because, you know, she's in her 70s and not going to change the way she speaks. But yeah, the accents are a problem with the voice activation stuff.
And the voice activation is a problem for the accents.
Well, yeah, depending on the direction you want to take that.
It seems to understand when my terrible fake northern accent quite well, so I'm pretty happy with that. But yeah, I didn't quite see where you're going at first with that, but that does seem to be a shift towards the mean as far as accents are concerned.
Well, and then there's also the problem that a lot of smart visual things, smart has air quotes there for everyone listening, problems they have with different skin colors. There was the thing with Kinect way back where it couldn't see people of color. I've seen video of soap dispensers that use some sort of light signal to dispense soap that couldn't detect certain individuals. I'm surprised we haven't heard anything about the face unlocking part of the iPhone having issues. Maybe Apple did a better job than we expected.
It is really good, to be fair.
Yeah, I haven't heard issues with that, but I have heard issues of it having already been cracked by people with a mask, but also...
Oh, yeah.
But also, like, family members, like a mother and son, were mm-hmm. looking at it, and they could both unlock it. Ooh. RIP.
Interesting.
Yeah, the face lock is not the unbreakable thing that Apple has been touting it as, but it also doesn't seem to be quite as susceptible as a lot of skeptics thought it would be before it came out.
I've not seen it touted as unbreakable, just to play devil's advocate here, but
there was a lot in the Apple fanboy area. Like, right. John Gruber was Daring Fireball was very bullish on the this is fine, nobody's ever gonna break this, Apple knows what they're doing. And then of course, like a week later, it had been broken by both masks and family members. So
because, you know, no one's ever gone to like a concert and seen somebody who looked like a friend.
It never happens. Yeah, I get it. Apple's doing the best they can, and I'm sure it's an amazing bit of technology. I haven't played with it myself, so I can't say how I really feel about it. But yeah, it's not going to be impervious. There's no such thing.
Yeah, I don't think it ever was supposed to be, right? It's a convenience feature more than anything.
Sure.
It's nice in that, like, I pick my phone up and I swipe to unlock and get to the home screen, and just in that motion, it tends to have unlocked most of the times. Mm-hmm. It's surprisingly quick. I haven't found it unlocking for random people, but then again, I've only tried it with like 3 or 4 different people.
You're not just walking around putting your phone in front of other people's faces.
Pointing my phone at people.
Just next time you get on the tube, just show your phone to every single person you pass.
Yeah.
And just see if it unlocks for any of them.
I can see that lasting a long time. Yeah, that's gonna people are gonna love it.
Have you had the opportunity to compare Siri and Alexa?
Yes.
What is the final verdict?
It seems like Alexa understands what I want more frequently than Siri does. Then again, I ask Siri different things. I haven't done like direct side-by-side comparisons, but I do try and use both frequently. So I really would like it if Siri would, like, for some inexplicable reason, if I ask it to play like a YouTube video or a film on my Apple TV, it doesn't know how to do that, and it really should. That is the thing that I want it to do most.
That
most
seems like an easy request for Siri.
It just has no knowledge of the Apple TV. I can't make it do anything or interact in any way with the Apple TV. It's very strange.
If we're talking voice assistants, and I'm going to shill something, my favorite is Hound from SoundHound, because I've been using that for the past couple years. I got it like the day it came out on iOS, and I really enjoy it. It's super responsive. I talk really fast. Fairly regularly, and so, but I can talk to Hound at normal talking speed, and Hound always picks up what I have to say, and it usually returns accurate results. So, yeah, I've always been really impressed with Hound. Google Assistant has also gotten better, but yeah, Hound has always kind of been my go-to app for voice assistants.
Is Hound a just general voice assistant, or does it have a specific focus?
It's a standalone, so it's just a standalone that does general stuff, but you can tell it to play YouTube videos, or look things up, or ask about restaurants, and have it sort, and it does context, which is super important in voice recognition, because I can be able to ask, like, what about these restaurants, and then sort them by rating, and rather than being saying, like, can you sort restaurants by rating within 50 miles, I can just sort by rating, and it just sorts, because it's based upon the context of what you just asked. Hound has always been super impressive to me.
We've been using Google products mostly in our house, so we have a Google Home and Chromecast, and then my wife and I both have Pixels, so we use the Google Assistant quite often, and it seems to be really, really solid. Like, compared to a year or so ago when we were using Apple products, Siri was absolutely terrible at doing almost anything you wanted it to do, but Google Assistant is pretty good at it, with one exception that we've had. The context thing is amazing. I'm going to jump back to that real quick before I talk about the problem. The context is amazing, and Siri also had a lot of problems understanding children's voices, as I have 2 children. That's a thing I've dealt with. Google Assistant is really good at that, though. I don't know what Google did, but they've gotten really good at identifying just whatever voice. The problem we had was a really weird one. My wife set an alarm on the Google Home to go off daily at noon. So every day at noon, have an alarm for this task she wanted to do. And it was impossible for us to cancel that alarm without factory resetting the Google Home.
What?
Like, I contacted Google. Like, I was chatting with the Google Home support staff. I'm like, I've got this alarm. It won't turn off. How do I stop this alarm? And they're like, oh, just tell it to cancel all future alarms. I'm like, yeah, we've done that about 4 times now. Have you deleted the alarm in the Home app? Yep, done that. Have you unsynced and reattached the accounts? No, but we'll try that. Alarm still goes off. So factory reset, and now it works great. So whatever you do, never set a repeating alarm on your Google Home.
Wow. That is a really strange bug.
Study size of one, but never do it. Ever. But yeah, it's a weird problem to have, you know? Not the kind of thing that you expect to have. So our next topic.
So I think you wanted to talk about InfoSec and Maori, Ken. So I'd done some InfoSec stuff, but I've never heard of Maori. So I am interested in this topic in particular.
Yeah, the Maori are an ethnic group in Oceania, mostly in like New Zealand area, right? So New Zealand, maybe parts of Australia, Tasmania, that kind of part of the world. So they're a group that a lot of people would recognize if they saw them. They often have very striking facial tattoos, look somewhat Polynesian-ish. So anyway, they have a long, long history going back that's very, very founded in their tattoos and in their artwork and in stories that they tell. There's a lot of considerations that have to come into play for them and things being digitized and digital security just as well. And so the paper was really interesting. It comes to us from, I don't actually know the name of the organization that put it out, but it's like a Maori focus, and I may be pronouncing that word wrong, but a Maori focused organization, excuse me. And it's really interesting because like they consider pictures of their artwork to be maybe not sacred, but at least of sensitive subject matter. So how do you handle the storage and transmissions of those things in a respectful way? And even the usage of their names, because their names often contain accents and it's you don't typically want to shorten them. And you may often have problems with like doing a first letter of the first name plus last name or vice versa. You may end up getting words that are considered offensive to them in their language. They want photos kept separate of living people versus dead people and landmarks, things like that. It was a really interesting PDF talking about different considerations to take into account.
Sorry, I'm not sure I missed you saying this, but is this a specific like service that they're trying to get these standards against? Or
it looks like this was published by someone out of New Zealand, and they're simply talking about how exactly do you accommodate Maori culture as you try and do digital age stuff as well.
Right. There's a lot like of things... In the U.S., this may not be a large concern, right? U.S., Europe, Africa, this may not be a large concern. But if you were, say, a government agency in New Zealand or Malaysia or Australia, these may be much larger concerns that you have to have about how you capture and store data relating to these people. I mean,
yeah, this
like, just
actually super interesting.
Just like one of the bullet points here is the copying and storing the tattoos, the skin art can be considered offensive, and they even remark that it's the digital equivalent of the trade of shrunken heads or human skin as art, which is the thing that a lot of people may not think about, but it goes back to, you know, we have there's the several articles that are like things programmers believe about dates, things programmers believe about time or names or whatever, right? This kind of goes back into that same vein of you thought you understood all of these concerns, but there's a whole lot that really, really depend on cultural norms that you haven't thought about or probably haven't.
Yeah, this is an interesting one. Have a flexible policy for usernames. Often a last name dot first initial or vice versa can spell a derogatory word. Huh.
Yeah. So, I thought it was interesting, especially just for being something that as a white American male I don't typically think about. But yeah, read through it, and even if you can't use any of these, like if this group isn't a large part of your target demographic or your users period, then maybe these aren't things you have to concern yourself with right now. But it's just interesting to kind of consider that there are other ways that storing or parsing data could be considered problematic.
This is super interesting, actually. Sorry, I am now reading this PDF because this is actually super interesting.
You're just now getting to it. Great.
I don't know anything about the Maori. Can you talk more about their culture, Ken? I'm kind of lost here.
I honestly can't speak to a large part of it. I mean, most of what I know comes from, you know, pop culture or just random, you know, interesting readings. So I can't do a huge amount of backfill on that.
Right.
I guarantee you Wikipedia has tons of information on this. But yeah, it's a similar idea to how we would, had it not happened hundreds of years ago, this is a similar document to the documents we would have to the approach of InfoSec and Native Americans, or InfoSec and Native Australians, or even, you know, Africans in the areas that were conquered by Europe, right? To where we would ideally want to have these same kinds of considerations to their religious and cultural history and their religious practices, cultural practices, to where we don't want to create offensive storage scenarios.
This is fascinating.
Yeah, and I think we could even tie it back to what I mentioned before with the accents becoming less prevalent or approaching that.
DNA is not owned by the individual. Oh.
Well, yeah, a lot of this is going to go into, you know, cultural ideals, right? So,
yeah.
Politically, legally, we might be able to say that DNA does belong to the individual, and we can use that to identify an individual, right? And maybe we have the right to store it for, I don't know, security or crime tracking or whatever, right? So then it becomes an issue of, okay, well, how do we deal with the cultural norm of DNA doesn't belong to a person, so you can't get that person's permission to take it, versus, well, legally we need to have a copy of this, right? It's similar to a thing we have in the U.S. Religion seems to be worldwide, so I'm assuming it's in the rest of the world as well, but especially in the U.S., of, what is it, the Seventh-day Adventists or the Jehovah's Witnesses that won't accept blood transfusions?
Oh,
I think it's,
yeah,
Jehovah's Witnesses.
Yeah, I think it's.
And so it becomes the problem of, well, how do we handle this group of people in a life-saving situation? Do we go against their religious wishes and give them the blood transfusion that will keep them alive? Or do we abide by their decisions knowing that they may die from it?
Did you, on that same line, did you see that that article about the guy who had the do not resuscitate tattoo? And they like ran into this ethical issue. Like, doctors were like, is this binding? Like, am I supposed to?
I saw that come up, but I didn't get to read it.
Yeah, they ended up not resuscitating him based upon that tattoo. So he was because of the DNR tattoo, he was not resuscitated.
Whoa.
So that's another super interesting thing. Like,
I kind of feel like that's appropriate.
Was it like definitely do not resuscitate? Was it not like a band reference or something like that?
No,
because
it said do not resuscitate right underneath his neck.
Yeah, DNR. it was like DNR a large like cross chest tattoo,
okay.
Of,
okay,
do, yeah, not resuscitate. But even if it was a band, like, you can't expect, say, the emergency room doctor to know, right? Like,
right,
they may have to make a decision within 15 minutes, a half an hour, and they don't have time to go, well, is this a band name? Is this some sort of in-joke with his friends? Like, why does he have Do Not Resuscitate tattooed on him? You kind of have to,
right,
just assume he put this
he
on his body for
be
a reason.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The thing is that, like, the comment section was very split, because I read through the comments, and of course people get, like, really upset about stuff like this, and there were paramedics saying that, like, if I had seen this, like, I'm still resuscitating him because I don't know what it means. And I was like, yeah, but, like, it says do not resuscitate, like, but they're like, yeah, but it's a tattoo, like, is it binding? And so there was, like, a whole, like, legal argument. They, like, called an ethics committee in, like, had to, like, evaluate whether or not to resuscitate this guy. Super interesting article. I'm mentioning it because somebody has to put it in the show notes now, but not me, because I have finals. Haha.
I could see it being a thing, too, where different groups could have different reasonable assumptions on what to do there. Like, a paramedic may do the resuscitation thinking, my job is to get this person to the hospital, to get this person to more long-term serious care, right? And
right,
the hospital then makes the decision of, oh, okay, but because of this tattoo, if they flatline again, we have to just leave them. Along that same line, and I will have to find this so it can go in the show notes, there was a really great article from I do believe he was an emergency room doctor. I don't believe he was an emergency room, like, coordinator or whatever. But we had the shooting in Las Vegas a couple months ago at the country music concert. I don't remember who was performing. And there were hundreds of people that were shot. And so this person was a doctor in one of the closest emergency rooms. And they had been going through training and scenarios for how to deal with massive, massive amounts of people being shot. Like, how do you process and deal with those people? And because of that, they put into play a plan for how to triage and handle hundreds of people. And they processed, I can't remember what he said the number was, I want to say like 250 people, 500 people, something like that, in a few hours. It was really neat because as he's working through it, this bottleneck would pop up. You know, we've got a bunch of people piling up in this one area. Okay, well, go in there and we need to process them in this slightly different way so that we can get through them faster. At one point, they ran out of, like, ventilators. So he rigged up, like, seriously MacGyvered a system of using a Y-tube, so a tube that splits off into two other pieces, and, like, doubling the pressure on one ventilator so that it could ventilate two people on the Y-tube. Just absolutely ridiculous amounts of jury rigging and just solving the immediate problem. It was really great.
I like... So I'm going to say I like that kind of situation, and I don't mean, you know, people in hospital and mass shootings and stuff like that. I mean emergencies in which the standard procedures kind of can't apply because they're either too time consuming or there's not enough people to make any kind of reasonable consensus. It's just you have to make a decision very, very quickly, and you have to have rules for making these decisions in emergency situations. I think it's super, super interesting how different fields think about this. Like, in a previous life, I was involved in doing emergency response for quite large, like, web-based systems, and maybe you're losing tons of traffic on one service and you sacrifice another service to get that service back up and running for a while. It's kind of interesting the things that are allowed when, you know, everything has kind of hit the fan. Like, I imagine using a Y-tube in that way is frowned upon enormously in normal situations.
Yeah, like, I feel like at some point protocols break down as pressure mounts, right? Like, you end up in situations where you improvise in order to solve the immediate problem, and sometimes that violates protocols or is not considered, like, your go-to route, but you're like, I have 500 people that all of whom have been shot, and I need to solve this problem immediately, so this protocol is going out the window. I wonder if humans, like, prioritize which protocols go first based upon their reaction to the protocol when it was announced to them. Like, if they thought the protocol was ridiculous, like, is that the first protocol that gets thrown out the window when pressure mounts or when stressful situations happen? I don't know.
Any company or team that's doing this properly will have procedures for what happens in an emergency. Like, you'll know what mostly is and isn't allowed, but I guess that depends on how emergent the situation is. But
yeah, I mean, an emergency like where you have like 30 people that have been shot in a mass shooting is very different from a situation which you've had 500, right? Like, how do you hear all the time that, like, you can never truly prepare for those situations where you have 500 patients coming into the hospital, all of whom have been hit or shot and need immediate attention. Like, how do you prioritizing people becomes like fairly straightforward. Like, you obviously treat the most wounded first, but like in situations where you're running out of supplies, like which protocols get thrown away first in order for you to gain access to more supplies and treat those people. And I don't know if maybe that's something they go over. I wouldn't know. I mean, we'd have to have a doctor on from a Las Vegas hospital, I guess, and have a discussion.
Yeah. Well, and another of the things that he was talking about cleaning up was like, they had a process where, I can't remember which one of this. It wasn't like an X-ray, but it was another one of the, you know, like bodily scans they would do for detecting, you know, internal injuries or whatever, right? So normally they would have like the nurse who was associated with that would come out, grab a person, wheel them into the room, set them up on the table. The tech would do the scan, send those results to the doctor. So that became way too time consuming. So they made it basically where the nurse and the tech and the doctor all stayed in the room. They didn't leave the room. And other nurses and other, you know, paramedics or whoever would wheel people into the room as fast as possible. So you reduce the amount of time that people were running around. So it's like these micro optimizations, but they go really, really far when you're dealing with vast numbers of people. So anyway, yeah, I'll be sure and put that link in the show notes because it was a really great thing to read. I don't have a good segue to our last topic.
Speaking of show notes, we now generate our show notes in a different way.
Right. Speaking of micro-optimizations, I made it slightly easier for us to create show notes.
Quote-unquote micro, that was major.
So I think all of us, well, at least three of the four, Sam did not add himself to this, but I know he said he wanted to talk about it, wanted to talk about static site generators. I tried to mess with Hugo this week.
You totally had some problems, yeah.
I totally broke it. It was a good time. So for those who don't know, Wall True FM is now hosted on a Hugo static site generator for us to be able to post content easier. And Hugo is a Go-based, static site generator. And so I think Sam wants to talk a little bit about Jekyll, and I'm cool with talking about Hugo. But what is a static site generator, Ken? Because I don't really know. I mean, I know it generates sites based upon templates, but yeah.
Right. So way back in the day, websites were all static, right? Because somebody just hand wrote HTML and put it up on a website. And then we got into the world of CMSs, where you would have software, you know, Python, Ruby, Java, whatever, running back in the background that people would type stuff into a text area, like, you know, WordPress, and that would store information in a database, and then whenever someone would come to the website, it would pull data out of the database and render the page. That's great, but if you're not doing something that needs live updated data really often, that's kind of a waste of time. You're putting stuff in a database and having to retrieve it from the database when it's not changing very often. So for the past 5 years or so, we've had quite a few options pop up in the world of static site generators, which generally the most basic idea is you give it a directory full of markdown files and you run a script and it will take all those markdown files, take whatever theme or templates that you've set up, and for every markdown file, inject it into that template and save out the resulting HTML page. And usually they'll link pages together so that you can, you know, click chronologically through a blog, or you can jump from section to section on a web page, on a website. And you've got a website that's built entirely from static content, so just from markdown files sitting on the file system, but it's generating a really nicely organized and rendered HTML page. And what's really cool is we're getting to the point now where people are building tools to take advantage of these static site generators. GitHub, for instance, will render static websites for you. You basically just say, hey, I want this to be a website. It'll look for HTML files and render them, and people can go browse your website. And then there's tools like Netlify. That is really hard to say out loud.
I was about to say, that sounds difficult.
Yeah, Netlify, which we use. And Netlify is a pretty amazing platform. They have free plans, they have paid plans, but you basically point them at a GitHub repo. Anytime you push to that repo, they will pull your files, run your build system. So for Hugo, it runs the Hugo command, which builds all the articles, templates, whatever, into your static site, and then they'll render your site for you. What's really cool is they'll also provide you with like an HTTPS certificate, they'll do form handling, they'll do script injection, they'll minify your CSS for you. Like, they will do a ridiculous amount of stuff. So yeah, they're awesome. But yeah, static site generator has been around forever. I've used Pelican, I've used Hyde, I've used Jekyll, I've used Hugo, there's several others I've used as well. They all work pretty well, and they're pretty awesome.
Yeah, I'm using Jekyll for my blog, and it's great. I don't even think about it anymore. I just have a directory that's filled with blog posts, and they get rendered. It's nice because you don't have any of the attack vectors that are associated with CMSs and databases and so on and so forth. It tends to be very, very quick because you're not going through a variety of processes. You're just fetching HTML and sending that back to the user. I'm not sure when it happened, like in terms of what year it happened, but whenever it did, I think it was a really good trend that started in the web.
I'm running a Hugo site, but it's currently broken. None of my pictures are showing up for anything.
I don't know how you've broken Hugo.
Yeah, dude, I'm really impressed.
At some point, I will help you fix that.
Oh, thanks.
We broke ours pretty significantly. Like, we moved, so in the beginning, when we made this podcast, we just had the domain. We put up a really simple not very nice, not very well thought through set of HTML, and I can say all of this because I wrote it, then a few episodes in, it became obvious that this is not going to fly. Like, just getting the show notes up was kind of tricky, and then you have to modify the podcast XML by hand, and it was all very blech. So Ken kind of incited this process to move to Hugo and make all this kind of stuff easier, but in the process we noticed more and more things had broken. And, it was an interesting week or so of trying to patch it all up, but we're in a much better situation
now. I still have several things I want to do for our site, but we'll get there.
But given that we didn't go through the feedback section at the start of this, so we may as well do that now, but the Wild2FM site now is a light theme rather than a dark one, so it should be a bit higher contrast. So if you're still having trouble reading the copy on the page, then please let us know. But
which is important. We're no longer on solarized dark, which is probably for the best.
Yeah.
And then we'll have host pages up sometime later this week. So if you want to know more about the weird people you listen to every week,
it'll
be there.
I knew I had something.
Yes, you have to get at the headshot, Sam. And we also have a form on the page now.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you told me not to bug you about it.
Yeah, I sorry.
He told me not to bug him about it either. I jumped in and told, I was like, hey, don't forget to do this. He was like, I just read about it. I was like, whoa. All right.
There's also a form now on the page where you can submit topic ideas or links or feedback, whatever, to us without having to raise like a GitHub issue. And that's all powered through Netlify. It's awesome. You post to it and it just sends us a message on Discord. It's the most...
It does. It just sends it straight into a channel.
I so wish Netlify sponsored us.
So now you guys don't need to set up accounts.
I wish Netlify sponsored because, oh man, I love their product so much.
You would shill their product like another. If Hound sponsored us, I would shill them. If Yumly sponsored us, I would shill them too.
We've already had an offer to Casper.
Yeah, we're all fine with new beds. But yeah, I use Netlify for my own personal site as well, and Hugo. That's why I recommended it for hours. But yeah, they're really great. So if you have a website, you have a blog, you have you just need to show off your portfolio, consider using a static site generator.
Don't
listen to Dan.
Don't do what I did.
But consider using a static site generator. I thought it was funny. You were talking with somebody on ProgDisk in the Go channel and told them about Hugo and mentioned me, and they asked me if they would be able to learn like basic web development with Hugo. I don't know that I would suggest that as the route for learning web development. There's a lot of bits and pieces involved in static site generators. So,
yeah, it just broke on me day one.
I feel the need to introduce a new section to the podcast called Errata because I made a mistake when I said that I'd bought a Casper mattress.
What did you buy?
Here
it comes. No. Right. Well, this is our correct section of the Wild2FM podcast called Errata, sponsored by Sam Hu, who made a mistake.
This is now production code 0004A.
We actually bought Simba mattresses rather than Casper, which sounds suitably similar.
That's
my defense.
Does it?
They both end in
totally different words.
The sound, and they're both like the same length and screw you.
So Casper only ends in the sound if you're British and don't pronounce your R's.
Casper. Yeah, I bought a right. Casper versus a Simba. Yeah, you're right. The Simba sleep mattress. Wow. Oh, holy moly. They had their entire mattress like expands. I don't know if anyone's been to their website, but if you scroll down, their entire mattress expands as you scroll past.
I really don't want to talk about mattresses again. I'm being assaulted by advertising.
Yeah.
Every time I go on YouTube, it's for purple.
Poor Leth has been doing our show notes. And so he goes through and researches all these links and puts them in very detailed show notes. So if you were impressed by our show notes quality, that is all Mike. And so he has been researching mattresses for the past week, and he posted in our Discord the other day that he is being assaulted by mattress ads, which is fantastic in my mind. But
I mean, I've been moving, so I haven't even done the show notes in full for episode 4 yet, but I did put Casper down in the show notes, and I made sure it was the right site by going to it, and just that one thing, that was the only mattress thing I ever did. And now they won't leave me alone.
You're moving back to Washington State this week, right? Right, Mr. Mike.
I am indeed back home.
Back home.
Somewhat in shame, but I have enough money that saved up that I think I'll be okay for a while.
Nice. Because Ken has been mentioning it in several episodes, I have finally gotten an internship, to which his response was, now you need to get a job. Because...
yep.
thanks for the clapping. I appreciate it. Thanks. So yeah, I have landed an internship. Mike is moving. So the show may be a little bit late. You may be hearing this a little bit later than usual as we work through audio stuff. But that is our list of things. Did anybody have anything else they want to talk about?
I think we're good.
Nice. Well, fantastic. So on behalf of the entirety of the Wild True FM podcast team, including Ken, Mike, and Sam, and myself, thank you so much for listening to this episode of Wild True. You will find down below on Wild True FM's show notes, including all the topics we have talked about today, and links to our social media, including our Twitter and the GitHub for this website in particular, and Wild True FM. Please feel free to submit a pull request if you see any issues or have complaints. Thank you for listening again, and we shall see you in 2 weeks.